This is Allison Bailey, your host for Practice Made Perfect podcast series. Considering the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, we decided to add additional podcast content focused on this emergency and what's important for our cardiovascular team now. We're doing this for several reasons. We know that patients with cardiovascular disease are at higher risk of infection with COVID-19 and develop more severe complications if infected. Additionally, we're learning COVID-19 has cardiovascular complications associated with the virus, so we will almost certainly be seeing these patients. And the cardiac care team will almost certainly be in the trenches trying to help develop solutions for our higher risk patients, whether that be in the hospital or the clinic. Obviously, this is in flux and will change rapidly, so make sure you're listening to the most current information at any given time, and we'll update things as available. Thank you and stay safe. This is Allison Bailey, and I'll be your host today on this special edition of Practice Made Perfect. I'm very excited to welcome an all-star group of physicians who are currently battling the COVID virus in some of the hot spots in the United States. Today we have with us Norma Keller, who's the Chief of Cardiology at Bellevue Hospital, NYU, and also serves as a governor of the New York chapter of the American College of Cardiology. Welcome, Norma.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Jim Horowitz, who is the CCU Director at NYU Kimmel. Jim, glad you're here.
Thanks for having me.
Karen Stout is joining us from the University of Washington, where she serves as Associate Chief of Cardiology. Karen, glad you're here.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks.
Also joining us is Amir Kaki, who serves as the Director of Mechanical Circulatory Support at Ascension St. John Hospital in Detroit, Michigan.
Thank you for having me.
And last, but certainly not least, we have Ajay Kirtani, who is the director of the NYP Columbia Cardiac Catheterization Labs. Ajay, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So as the COVID-19 pandemic continues, we know that everyone is preparing for the coming weeks and learning how to care for these patients. So we thought it was important to talk to some physicians who are currently on the front lines and already dealing with this situation. So tonight, we're going to be talking about what you need to know now, managing individuals with COVID-19, either positivity or probability. So we thought we'd start with talking about how to handle the typical cardiac arrest or a STEMI situation in a COVID-positive or a COVID-probable patient. Norma, what are you all doing with protocols and quickly screening these patients to assess the status of the virus?
Yeah, so we did some prep work in terms of thinking about cardiac emergencies and how to best handle them in these vulnerable patients where you also have to protect the providers. So we looked at our protocols and we did actually did simulations in both our CCU as well as the cath lab. We started with the CCU and we had a simulation for cardiac arrest, and it was very telling and we learned a lot from it. We have a Team E here, which is a team that's dedicated to taking care of COVID patients. And they have a cardiac arrest team that consists of a hospitalist and anesthesiologist and a critical care intensivist. And they will respond to cardiac arrest, but, you know, since they're taking care of a lot of patients, they might not get there right away. So we wanted to make sure our team was prepared. So what we do is every shift, the nurses identify the primary and secondary nurse. The primary nurse is the nurse taking care of the patient, and if that patient arrests, the secondary nurse will don outside the room. There's a monitor making sure no one enters the room without PPE because it's an instinct just to rush in to take care of a patient. So that's a role that's identified ahead of time as well. And the secondary nurse actually takes in a Lucas device so that you can do automatic compressions. And I think this is key for patients who have COVID. The Lucas enables you to free up a provider, so you're limiting exposure, and you're also distancing a provider from the airway, which, you know, during a code is really high risk for aerosolization during intubation, et cetera. And we've recommended hands-only CPR or Lucas until the anesthesiologist gets there to help with intubation if they have not been intubated before. The secondary nurse also brings in emergency medications in with them. And we learned all of these things from just running different codes and seeing what worked and what didn't work and making sure people were as protected as possible. So I think for cardiac arrest, identifying roles is really, really important beforehand. Signage on the door, which I'm sure everybody has, to alert someone, but also having a monitor there to make sure nobody is going in the room. And then using the Lucas really helps in terms of limiting exposure, so that you don't have to have an additional provider in the room doing CPR and really distancing someone from the airway, which is a high-risk field. Then we did the same thing in the cath lab. And Sripal Bangalore is our director of the cath lab, and he actually wrote up a protocol to take care of STEMI patients after we performed some simulations in the cath lab. And actually this weekend, we had a patient that was transferred over that had huge elevations infralaterally, but there was concern that maybe this was myocarditis, so there was a little reluctance to take the patient to the cath lab. We recommended that they intubate the patient there because they were hypoxemic and do another EKG, and the EKG was even more impressive, so the patient went directly to the cath lab. And I can tell you, if we hadn't done the simulation before, it really would have been problematic to do a COVID-positive patient and bring them directly to the cath lab. And it went pretty well. I mean, a couple of things that we ensure is that the team knows when the patient's coming, so that someone, again, is at the door and they don't go into the room until everything is ready. This patient was intubated, so we had respiratory therapy, the only person in the room initially, to convert the patient over and hook them up to our ventilator. And then we have just two nurses in the room to prep the patient while the interventionalist and the fellow is outside the room, donning and doffing. And then we actually limit what we're documenting and recording during the procedure to limit access as well. And, so doing a lot of handwriting outside the room and then re-entering that into the EMR afterwards, which is not perfect, but patient gets taken care of and you're limiting exposure of the providers. So I think the simulations are really, really helpful in many aspects of preparing to take care of the COVID patients, particularly when they have cardiac emergencies.
That is really great advice. So planning up front really protects both the patient and the care team. Ajay, at Columbia, what are you all doing with STEMIs? Are you still doing primary PCI, or are you considering lytic protocols?
Well, I think that the key things are that, the era has changed a little bit, and we used to think initially that we could do some basic screening to determine if someone was going to be COVID positive or rule out COVID positive. And the reality, at least now in New York, is with so much community spread, I think it can be safely assumed that anyone coming to the cath lab has a pretty high probability of becoming COVID positive, or they already are and you just don't know it. And so we really emphasize to the staff across the board that if you're taking the patient to the cath lab, that full PPE is needed. And especially in the cath lab, we advocated strongly for N95 specifically, rationale being that you never know in the cath procedure when someone's going to arrest, someone's going to need a shock, CPR, intubation, or even they start throwing up, for instance, from an inferior MI. As far as the issue of lytics versus primary PCI, I think this is something that many cath labs around the country are debating. The challenge here is that many of these patients may have a myocarditis or a pericarditis picture with normal coronaries, and there are multiple reports of this that have been seen. And if you give that patient lytics, you may not be helping the patient. You may actually be making it worse. So what we did is we instituted a handheld echo that goes to the fellow as part of our protocol. So those patients, if they have diffuse hypokinesis, then we won't even necessarily bring them patients to the cath lab. But we try to be a little bit more circumspect. There's so many cath labs that are so fixated on door-to-balloon time. This is not the time to think about door-to-balloon time. I think that it's something where we have to think and be more thoughtful about the types of patients we're taking and what we're actually trying to accomplish in the lab.
That's great advice. And I know for all of us who follow social media, this has obviously been a hot topic. And then likewise, I think another hot topic we're seeing in the air is what happens when these patients develop shock? Are there data about plans? What works? What are you doing in Detroit?
Yeah, so we're right behind New York on the incline of unfortunately of the slope, and so our cases are rising exponentially daily. We're seeing, I think Ajay's point is well taken, and we should all consider that we've had a couple of false alarms, ST elevations, which turn out to be pericarditis or myocarditis. We have not cannulated a patient using ECMO for shock. We've turned down four to date because of their comorbid conditions and limited resources. As it relates to the traditional shock, that we have not seen a traditional shock from an occluded artery per se, but the shocks that we've seen here are patients that have basically myocarditis and biventricular failure. And so far we have not used mechanical circulatory support on any of these patients thus far.
Okay, that sounds great. Is there a role for Impella or balloon pump in these patients, or are we thinking mostly ECMO?
I'll give you my opinion, and then we could hear what AJ has to say because they've seen more cases than we have. I think if you look at just strictly, if someone comes in with a true shock, it's probably, if it's related to COVID, I would suspect it's going to be biventricular from a profound myocarditis. In those cases, I think at least I could speak for our center where we have very limited ECMO kits available. If it was a young patient who was potentially viable and was oxygenating and the shock was strictly related to myocardial biventricular, we would consider bipellet in those patients to try to save our ECMO resources for patients that need it for oxygenation. That would probably be our strategy here. But we've been fortunate we haven't had to encounter that so far.
Yeah, on our side, at least the majority of the patients have some element of respiratory issue. And so those patients may already be on VV or being considered for it. And so typically it would be a VAV or just a VA ECMO in those circumstances. We have treated in our system a couple patients with balloon pumps, and it turns out that some of the myocarditis, they don't need as severe support as we might think. As far as the use of other forms of hemodynamic support, it's just a bit of a challenge in terms of bringing them down to the cath lab and then the post-management in the CCU. And my sense is that the prognosis with the COVID alone, especially for these patients that come in extremis, is so poor that it's not clear to me how much we're going to be helping by actually implementing mechanical support in these folks.
I think the bigger issue at the bedside is knowing whose myocardial function is depressed, which is to say, who do you echo? Who do you swan? And all of the rules that you typically have are upended because of the risk to your staff and your techs and your fellows for these procedures. And so your kind of situation for when you do these things totally changes. And what we've seen so far is that there's plenty of patients who have depressed EF with COVID, but that's because they had depressed EF before, because you have a lot of old folks. And we're all kind of waiting for that, what we've seen in China with like this second wave of people who recover from respiratory failure and then end up having myocarditis and then end up having cardiac shock. So it's a definitely moving target. And it's a question of how do you diagnose, when do you echo? I mean, we've swanned, I don't think we've swanned anyone yet. And then the question is, when do you echo, do you send the tech in and do a full study with like 47 echo measurements and leads and measurements at bedside, or do you have somebody come in with a point of care? And we've honestly been moving more and more to point of care, just basic images. And then if your basic images are awful, then maybe you assess who can go in and get a full study.
Okay, I think that's great information on the know. Karen, what are you doing with surveillance for myocarditis in these patients? Are you doing protocols for point of care echo as well?
Yeah, so we've really struggled with this. We had a preview of what things could look like with the initial outbreak here, and it happened that it was in a hospital that has a tie to a nursing home. And so they got a bunch of nursing home patients who, as everybody's already mentioned, had comorbid conditions, and they were definitely reporting out of their experience that there was this kind of terminal phase cardiovascular collapse in the setting of what looked like a systemic inflammatory response, you know, potentially, you know, immune-mediated, but then also this heart failure myocarditis sort of presentation occasionally as well. So when we got all, hey, well, we should be screening for that, it doesn't take you very long to look and say, we should look for that, to then say, well, but that's going to come at the risk of exposure, as already mentioned, in regards to who's doing the echo, if you're getting an echo, and even super simple things like labs. So if you've got a patient in isolation and the only labs you're going to get are a troponin, you got to feel pretty confident that that's actually worth the exposure risk to the phlebotomist, for example, if they're not nurse draws, if it's not an ICU patient. So if you're trying to like screen the folks that are on the acute care services who haven't made it to the ICU and trying to anticipate their cardiac dysfunction in a way that you could intervene, add dobutamine, which is anecdotally may be helpful, that sort of thing. I think the biggest thing for any of us doing this is to come up with policies, or at least, and they're not even policies, but come up with protocols that say we want to know, we think we can actually help some of these patients if we know about it early enough by sort of preemptively supporting them, even if it's with inotropic support and not devices. But then you have to really get into who's doing what and how much exposure risk are you subjecting them to by sending in a phlebotomist for one screening troponin or asking a sonographer or a fellow to take in a big machine, which is hard to clean. So what we've ended up doing is really focusing on point-of-care ultrasound and training our intensivists in as many of our hospitals as we can and making sure that we're using machines that record and where we can do offline strain and that sort of thing. And then as everybody else is doing, if you get to a space where you really need to be able to have more skilled hands or a better machine, we have some of the smaller, easier to clean echo machines that we're going to use, and the sonographers can go in, but we're going to be selective about that. But have the same strategy that others have mentioned, which is if somebody's coming in with an ECG that kind of looks like, is it infarct, is it myocarditis, echo is an awesome way to make a decision on that, you know, global dysfunction versus something regional, and it helps with the rest of your exposures that might come from trips to the cath lab and the like. So our protocols have really been very prospective in the sense of patient comes in, we want to get some basic screening stuff, but we are trying to really balance that against the exposure risks that are involved for the people who are having to do those things, even things as simple as an EKG and that sort of thing. So I think for everybody who's doing this, going through and saying, we want to be ahead of it, but to what gain? And if we're going to be ahead of it, how can we do it with the least exposure to personnel as conceivably possible?
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Jim, what are you doing in your unit? Are you seeing any role of biomarkers in being predictive for myocarditis?
No, we have the exact same experience, which is that, you know, some folks say, well, we should do a twice-a-day POCUS and look at the EF. But in reality, that's burning a lot of PPE and exposing a lot of folks to risk. And even as we heard before, like even doing like an EKG like exposes to risk. I'm not that familiar with what they're doing on the acute side. On the ICU side, we're following, you know, the troponin, the CPK, the LDH, the D-dimer, the IL-6, all these things. And we made an Epic note that pulls in all of these labs into the note, which I can share with anyone who wants them. It was exceedingly painful to figure out how to do this, but now that I know how to do this, it's great. I can add any labs I want to any note, and that's been very helpful. But basically, we're screening all of our echoes. You know, we get a million echo requests on these COVID floors, and we screen them with our echo director to see which ones are really important. And if they're unclear, they send them to me and my one colleague, Eugene Yarditsky, who's my other CCU attending, and then we'll do the bedside POCUS with the Lumify ourselves, if need be, just to get a sense of the EF.
And if I can hop back in with one other consideration as you're developing these is, so most of these patients are being cared for not so much in CCUs by cardiologists, but in variations of medical ICUs with pulmonologists. Obviously, it's a bad, horrible ARDS sort of thing. So if they get a bunch of abnormal labs and abnormal echoes and that sort of thing, they need to have a cardiologist to call on. And how are you going to do that? And are you going to do in-person visits or are you going to do virtuals? We're doing a lot of virtuals because you don't necessarily have to see the patient. You can review the imaging. You can review the labs. But I think one of the ways to help make people feel better that the screening that you're doing is going to be useful is to have built into that the idea of how they're going to get cardiology input when they need it. And you, as the cardiology team, are prepared to do that in a way that also balances your risks of exposure and that sort of thing. So I think if you can lay that out from the outset of saying, we'll see the patient in person if it's necessary to do so, but we will provide virtual consultation reviewing all the data and give you some guidance based on what we can see. And that's super helpful.
I agree 100%. What we've done, which has been really fulfilling, is that we've gotten an Epic workflow where if, let's say, a pulm fellow goes into the room to put in an A-line, they can do their point-of-care echo, and they can upload it via their Philips Lumify to Epic, and then the cardiology attending actually overreads it. And then we can decide if the echo looks X, Y, and Z to do a full study, because there is a risk to our text. And even our full studies now are very abbreviated, but that's how one of the ways we've been screening, and it's been pretty successful, I think.
Okay, no, that sounds great, and multidisciplinary and minimizing risk.
If someone who's going in the room already for something else can do it, then that's what you do, say PP.
Expanding just a little bit on the ICU skills, is anyone looking at training people in ventilatory skills and basic critical care from a cardiology standpoint, anticipating that need? Jim, what are you doing in the CCU?
We are very lucky that we have a Pulm Crit Care attending who just retired last year, who's been at NYU for like 40 years. And now he does just SIM. So he has developed a very short 4-hour curriculum for folks like cardiology fellows and attendings who have Crit Care experience to kind of quickly uptrain them for the things that you'll see with COVID, like the vent settings that we use, the labs you look at, and develop a very quick simulation-based criteria to bring them up to the game to practice.
Okay, wonderful. Karen, are you guys doing anything on the West Coast similar to that?
We are primarily using some of the online training modalities. And one of the things we're doing about deploying folks is we have a lot of, our teams are sort of mixed bags of attendings, nurse practitioners and PAs with extensive critical care experience, and fellows and hospitalists. One of the things I've spent a good chunk of time doing is really getting a sense of the skills and willingness of my faculty, including the nurse practitioners and hospitalists, and then our fellows, to be redeployed in different places. So in addition to trying to train people up, typically via either in-person or there's some online courses that people have been given the links to that are now free through CHEST and that sort of thing to be able to get up to speed. But we've also just been really considering who do we deploy where, so that if we have a bunch of critical care trained people who are in, say, the cardiothoracic ICU where there's a lull in business for the fact that we're not doing elective cases, then we can move them over and we don't actually have to train people up. We're taking the skills they already have and then redeploying them to the COVID units. So that's another strategy around that that can be useful.
Okay, I think that's great information for everybody that's planning on this potential wave of patients. And then the last thing I wanted to touch on was a little bit of a controversial topic that's gotten a lot of press recently, but the importance of personal protective equipment for frontline staff. So I think everybody's in agreement that we need to wash our hands as often as possible, not touch our face. When we're around these patients that we know are COVID positive, N95s are necessary. What ways can we further mitigate risk as far as PPE? Karen, would you like to tell us what you're doing?
Sure. Hospitals and hospital systems set policies that are based on a bunch of smart people whose expertise is this sort of thing, trying to balance the well-being of their healthcare workers, patients, and the durability of your PPE supplies. And you see a lot of different systems doing it different ways. And there becomes a perception that perhaps one way is better than the other. It's a droplet spread disease, and everybody's very consistent that hand hygiene is hugely important. And we've been really harping on that in particular. The other thing of if you even have anything that feels to you like you have any symptoms, you stay home and not use the PPE. That whole, like, I'm coming to work with a mask because I have the sniffles is no longer a thing. That doesn't happen. So our institutional policies are being constantly evaluated and revised. And what we've really focused on is how do you make sure that people are protected in the highest risk situations? It's a droplet-borne illness, but there are circumstances where it gets aerosolized. And when it gets aerosolized, the people who are, for example, somebody intubating somebody needs to be maximally protected in that moment, and then the room needs to be dealt with after the fact. And I think one of the things we've seen is if you're cavalier about the PPE, then you don't necessarily have enough of it, but also you're stressing the entire system in a bunch of funky ways. If you get one of the things with PPE is, oh, well, let's just assume everybody's positive until proven negative. And in addition to blazing through a lot of PPE, if you do that, you also are getting the environmental services folks have to come in and clean the rooms differently than they would if you kind of handled things a little differently. So I think every system has to balance those things to protect their healthcare workers, but our guys are certainly emphasizing hand hygiene as being just a fundamental basis for dealing with a droplet-based disease.
Okay, and in New York, or is anything different happening with such widespread community spread of the virus?
Yes, we're doing a lot of the same, and I'd have to say we're also trying to professionally distance. If we need to have rounds, we're making sure it's in a large room, and so really, really conscious of professionally distancing within the hospital. It's a little tough on elevators, I have to say, but I think that has become a different mindset for us. And there is a lot of anxiety, particularly with our nurses, and I think the more you communicate with them and talk to them, and also, you know, they get a little nervous when they see someone walking around with an N95 who has no interaction with patients. So really trying to ensure that people are following the recommendations is reassuring to them as well.
Okay, good. Ajay, anything different at Columbia or basically the same premises?
I would agree. I think that the biggest thing that's important, especially for those that are not in the midst of it right now, is to recognize that as community spread advances, any potential interaction is an exposure interaction. And so in a sense, this all this distancing is really important to just sort of do in daily life, but it also allows you to relax a little bit because you sort of maintain the same standard across all interactions that you do rather than sort of titrating it up or down. The final part of it I'll mention is that some of this in terms of shifts on and shifts off and alternating staff, particularly for cath lab personnel, is a good way to avoid, for instance, quarantining or having a whole bunch of people out at the same time. And so you kind of do your work and then you leave the premises. You don't sort of hang around. And those types of things are reasonable ways of managing it.
When you're doing your workforce planning, being able to give people some space away, you know, kind of the week on, week off sort of concepts, is super important. And as a state that just yesterday had a stay-at-home order put in place, having had social distancing in place for weeks now and everything closed and that sort of stuff, that social distancing is really important. I think we actually have seen some of the benefit of it here a little bit in terms of the pace of new cases. We'll see if that actually plays out over the next couple of weeks. It might not. But I think in general, that idea of really, if you don't need to be at work, don't go to work. And giving people permission to do that for people who are in leadership roles. It's a hard-charging group of people, right? And they need permission to just stay home and make that be okay.
Another important element about PPE is if you really have a high clinical suspicion that someone has COVID and a test comes back negative, continue the PPE and just assume it's COVID and trust your clinical judgment as opposed to the test result.
Okay, also good advice because the test obviously has a rate of missing the virus and sometimes needs to be retested. Well, I'm going to end by asking each of you, now that you've seen patients and you're in the middle of this sort of growing epidemic, what you wish you knew as a care provider last week or 2 weeks ago, so maybe it can help the rest of us who haven't yet started taking care of a lot of these patients. Amir, why don't we start with you? What do you wish you knew before you saw these patients that you can tell us?
Yeah, I think what I wish I knew 2 weeks ago was the scarcity of PPE. And I think it's really changed a lot of our clinical decisions as to what we do to patients. In cases, just as an example, there are three or four cases where under normal circumstances, we would have been very aggressive and tried to do more for these patients. But when we took into consideration the limited resources and the impact it would have on potential patients coming in, it's really altered our decision making. So I think the most important thing is that the PPE equipment, you could run through it a lot quicker than you think. It's very limited. And every clinical decision that you make as it relates to taking care of these patients, at least in cardiology, is usually a major undertaking that'll use a lot of resources. So I think that's the biggest thing that we've learned.
I think the biggest thing that I've learned is with the urban density that we live in with New York, the sheer amount that positive patients can multiply is something I've never seen before. And I don't think it will be the same in smaller cities, but I'm still not sure what's going to happen in New York. It's just growing fast, and it's really important that everybody do as much social distancing as possible. I was biking to the hospital 2 days ago, and there was a two-on-two basketball game going on, and I found that infuriating. And we need to all do our best to kick in and make sure this thing is silenced as much as possible.
Yeah, both those points are excellent. I think looking at our most precious resources is nursing, and that's the one I think that we all struggle with, having enough depth in nursing. And this is a disease where you really need a lot of depth of nursing, particularly if you're going to be proning and doing other things. So just trying to think, I think, creative ways to increase the force, you know, maybe mobilizing retired nurses that recently retired and other ways of just increasing the depth of our nursing pool.
You know, for me, I feel like I'm a pretty level-headed person. I try to be prepared when I go into things, and I generally am not caught off guard. But the one point I'd make to everybody here is you cannot over-prepare for this. You simply cannot. And if you feel like you were over-prepared in the end, then God bless you, because it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And so if I had known that better, I think we would have prepared even more. Maybe it wouldn't have done anything different, but I really want to just emphasize that to the listeners.
I would echo the idea that if we all come out of this feeling overprepared, then we won. But I actually think the thing, it's not so much what I wish I learned, but I've been so extraordinarily grateful to see, is a spirit of how can I help that is truly amazing, that everybody in our healthcare system and all of cardiology, you know, my faculty, our staff, everybody is saying, you need me to do something, you let me know, and I will do it. And the willingness to just chip in when now it's our turn, and we got to step it up and be prepared as best we can and then adapt as we go. I've found that despite the stressors that go with all of this, that the esprit de corps and the commitment to our patients is really inspiring. It's terrifying. It's awful. But there's also a lot of just truly amazing people doing amazing things that is the core of what you can all rely on. So if you can get yourselves planned and prepared and deal with as many contingencies as you can before it lands on your doorstep and then be flexible and adapt as you go, then those amazing people are going to be able to do great work the best we possibly can to take care of as many patients as we possibly can.
Okay. I'm going to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy clinical lives to share with me and our listeners things that are important for us to know to provide the best care for our cardiac patients. We'll try to put some resources along with the podcast from things the speakers have been talking about tonight. And we wish you all the best as you prepare to take care of COVID-19 patients. Thank you.